ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Trust in the media isn't what it used to be.
Why the mainstream media isn't reporting this, I do not know, but this is huge.
Sometimes it feels like no one can even agree on what's true anymore.
I don't trust the general public's ability to identify fake news.
So when anything can be faked, how do you keep your bearings? I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we sift the fact from the fiction. New episodes on ABC Listen every Tuesday and Thursday.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis, joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney. PK, there's a few stories running this week, and some of them come from you, really, from your four corners on Monday night, which was really terrific. And if you haven't watched it, everyone, you should go to iView and have a look. Most of them, too, have the government under pressure in one way or another, I think, on the economy, on national security, and on the new look front bench, which has really roared out of the block. New front bench is clearly desperate to sort of prove their mettle, I think. But top of the list is the efforts to return the so-called ISIS brides and their children. There's 34 of this group in total. They've been stranded in a detention camp in Syria since 2019 after the collapse of ISIS. This has been a story that's gone on now for some years, since that time, but it's in the news again this week because we learnt that these women and children had been issued with Australian travel documents. They had left their camp, trying to make their way back home, except they got turned around. And PK, the breaking of this story coincided with this emboldened new opposition front bench, and we saw a swag of shadow ministers really hammering the government to keep these people out, to keep Australia safe. The Prime Minister was, I think, surprisingly for some, very strident, cold-hearted even, in his message that the government is not and will not be helping these women and children return home.
We won't repatriate them, and indeed the government was taken to court by one of the non-government organisations saying that we had a responsibility, and they weren't successful in that. My mother would have said, if you make your bed, you lie in it. These are people who went overseas supporting Islamic State.
But PK, this story feeds right into Angus Taylor's hardline shut the door immigration agenda and puts Labor under pressure, doesn't it?
It's the issue he likes to talk about because he knows his front bench wants him talking about it because they're under so much pressure from One Nation.
And we'll get to One Nation.
Well, we always do at the moment, don't we? Let's just go to Angus Taylor. He outlined his new look shadow front bench, really interesting elevations, some interesting and very predictable, really, snubs, and then some non-snubs, like people like Tim Wilson, who he did not snub. And I think that's really interesting given, you know, he didn't vote for him and he's given him a prominent role in shadow treasurer. And that means that Jim Chalmers is facing a new sparring partner, the Jimmy Timmy mix up.
Jimmy Timmy, I haven't seen that.
Jimmy Timmy is what it's all about. And I know someone who's all over the Jimmy Timmy vibe. Phil Currie, political editor at the Australian Financial Review. Welcome to the Party Room.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Phil, if Jimmy Timmy was your line, congratulations. I'm not I missed it.
That's all right. Jimmy V. Timmy.
Jimmy V. Timmy will come to. But yeah, Let's start with the women and kids stuck in that Syrian camp, the so-called ISIS brides. The Prime Minister has been very hardline, as we heard, in response to these this story that they're on their way home and pressure from the opposition for the government to stop them returning here using something called temporary exclusion orders.
And so it is of incredible concern, I think, to most Australians that these people want to come back to Australia. And if one person has been hit with a temporary exclusion order for going to this part of the world and doing what they've done, why is it not the case that the others have not been had the same order applied against them?
So, I think if we go back in time, Phil, as I understand it, Anthony Albanese, as PM, has actually been very closed completely closed on this issue for some years. But it's a very difficult thing for a Labor government to manage, isn't it? I mean, the law of the land, or for any government really, the law of the land deems Australian citizens can return home unless our intelligence agencies say they can't temporarily because they've broken our laws. But, you know, it seems like the details, the way this has played out this week, the details are being dragged out of the government. And now we finally know that one of these women has been issued with an exclusion order. That's only happened this week. That of those who have returned in the past years, 10 of them have faced charges, though we don't know how many were convicted. So, you know, the issues got very hot very quickly, which underscores the political stakes as both sides sees it, but also perhaps the sensitivity in the community on this issue of these women who travelled to the Middle East to support ISIS.
Yeah. Look, Fran, to me, the government's reaction, and it's more hard line than, especially when it comes to the children, than Scott Morrison adopted a few years ago.
Completely different.
These young children who are coming back to Australia, they can't be held responsible for the crimes of their parents. I mean, the fact that you would take a child and put them in a conflict zone like this is despicable, and I find it disgusting. But the children can't be held responsible for that.
We repatriated some of the kids back then.
We did. We've repatriated, just to fill people in, we've repatriated quite a few of these women and children.
Mm. But what it reflects, this sort of hardline approach from the government, is it's a product of the political environment at the moment, the attitudes towards migration, the buttons that One Nation is pushing, and the increased sort of sensitivity about Islamic extremism following Bondi. And remember late last year, was it, or earlier this year, when it was revealed some of these ISIS brides had returned, and trying to get any details out of the government, out of Tony Burke and so forth, trying to get blood out of a stone. It was all done secretly, and that sort of got a big run on social media and stuff, and was quite damaging to the government. The right jumped onto that, and I just think in this environment Albanese's decided he's just got to be ruthlessly sort of hard line on it, because how this is running in the community to remove these issues.
I think that's absolutely correct, that he's made a political calculation. And in many ways, Phil, let's call it for what it is. This actually does show, this is a product of the higher polling for One Nation and the shift on immigration issues to the right and the moves on all of this. Like, this is actually Labor responding to that pressure too. We talk a lot about the coalition. But actually, that's how I see it anyway.
I don't see it like that. I think that's a misreading of it, that this is just happening post-Bondi and post those One Nation polls. Because I was speaking to a few people within the government who say the Prime Minister has been very hardline on these people since they facilitated the bringing home of those women and kids back in 2022, and that he doesn't have any truck with him, that's the view of the Prime Minister and the view of most in the Cabinet. Most of all in the Cabinet, as I understand it, and that he has actually led this hardline position for some years. So it's not a new thing.
But didn't a bunch come home last year?
Yeah, but not with government support.
No, but Morrison had a similar view. Your support is passive. Like, they're entitled to everything you're entitled to, but you don't go out of your way to facilitate their return. But I still think the language around this, you made your own bed, this sort of thing, too bad regarding the kids. Just the optics of this is much tougher.
I think it reflects how the Prime Minister does think about this.
I'm disagreeing with you, Fran. It's politics.
Oh, I'm not saying it's nothing to do with politics, PK. I think the Prime Minister, don't forget, he's been a minister in government, Labor governments, for a long time, and he's seen how Labor gets walloped on these national security issues and immigration issues.
Yeah. So politics.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is I don't think it's in response to these One Nation polls.
Oh, I think it's being fueled by it. If the electorate was feeling a little bit more charitable, he might, sort of not be so hardline in his rhetoric. You've got to remember, One Nation on the rise, they've cannibalised the Liberal vote and the National Party vote. And to this point, Labor has been firewalled. The Progressive vote, the Labor Greens vote is not being sort of affected, but it's very much under threat. Just immigration is such a burning issue out there now, and it's being blamed for so many things. It's become the sort of, you know, the it's like the punching bag for nearly every one of society's problems.
That's true.
And I Labor is very acutely aware of this, and they're exposed to it. You know, we ran another survey in our paper today from John Scales, JWS Research. Every three months or so, they gauge the issues of concern for voters. And immigration, since November last year, was sitting at about 26%. It jumped 8 points to 34. And the only thing happened between that and now was Bondi. It's, you know, you talk to the One Nation people, they say, you know, Hanson was polling around 19%, which was already very high before Bondi. Now they're polling at 26. All these things have been conflated in the community, whether it's housing or, you know, national security and these sorts of things. And, you know, it's probably for a government trying to manage something as sensitive as ISIS brides, you couldn't probably get a worse environment in terms of trying to walk down the middle on it.
And so where does that leave them? Is it just – where does it leave the actual – so-called, I hate the term ISIS brides.
I know.
But anyway, where does it leave them? They're just stuffed, right? If there is...
Pretty much.
Those poor children, can we...
Well, of course you can.
Thank you.
The kids.
I feel so terrible for the kids.
I assume there's not a great deal of sympathy in the community for the women who went over there, but it's hard to blame a kid for the sins of the mother or the father.
Yes.
But it's an awful situation. I sort of agree with that argument that the UN and others make, say, look, they're your citizens, they're your problem.
Yes.
Right? You let them leave. So ultimately, this is a problem the world has now. People are just dumping their unwanted people and someone else, you know, to deal with. I think you sort of ultimately have a responsibility to, you know, if they do come back, to deal with them. But
again, Australia's been facing down that line of persuasion for a long time. I remember back in 2019 when that first group came home, US officer came out very clearly and said, Australia, we will help you. We will send our soldiers in to escort these citizens home. They are your citizens. Take them home. And now this camp's about to close. The Syrian government is saying, get them. We don't want them. Everyone, all the countries that have people in these camps, can you work out a way to make it happen? But the Australian government is, you know, pretty crystal clear that it's not going to help. That doesn't mean that they can't make their way home with the travel documents. And I think, of course, we should feel, I mean, awful for these children. And there's been the argument put by security agencies in the past that leaving them here is actually a future danger, if you like, because are these children growing up and being radicalized in these camps? You know, is that what we want? The important question now is to look out, and we're finding some of this information, is to how are the people that have returned, and there's quite a few of them, how are they being monitored? Is Australia being kept safe? Have they posed any threat? These are the answers that I think is the only evidence or ammunition for those who are concerned about these people who are stuck there to convince the Australian community really that it is safe to bring them home. Because, you know, for their own privacy reasons, we don't know anything much about how they're living and how they're, you know, what sort of surveillance they might be under. Are they a danger, which is the claim made by the opposition and certainly by One Nation.
I sort of, from a political point of view, you sort of got to look at the counterfactual. Imagine if Albanese stood up and said, look, we're going to let them back home. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine the reaction?
Yeah, that'd go down well.
Yeah.
But as Scott Morrison did in 2019, we're going to let them home because these children shouldn't pay the price, and we are going to throw all the sort of laws of the land that we have at them to make sure that they are not a danger when they get here. Isn't that the next sentence? So, mood has shifted.
I'm with Patricia on this. It's just been governed solely by the politics.
I'm
not disputing your point either, Fran, but I just think that the complete hardline response here is a product of what's going on, the sort of broader society. There may be very few people who even care about these people, let alone want them back, but would only get exercised if they did come back. Look at the reaction when we found out some had come back, whenever it was, a few months back. You know, it was it was a big issue. So I don't know. It's easier for Albanese to do what he's doing than to
it is.
Sort of nuance
so it. Let's go to the broader, which we've alluded to 100 times, but we're going to do it properly now, which is the broader context. Pauline Hanson's comments, for instance, this week on no good Muslims. That's pretty much what she said.
What it's all about. You know, you say, oh well, there's good Muslims out there. Well, I'm sorry. How can you? You know, tell me there are good Muslims. If jihad is ever called, and people must understand this, go and research, go and understand about this.
There's been a lot of outrage about the comments. She sort of tried to walk them back, but then really didn't. I don't know. Did you see it as a walking back? Not really.
No.
She kind of doubled down. What do you think, Phil?
Like, she didn't walk back at all, and she certainly didn't apologise.
But is it the moment? Is it the moment? You know how there's been this thing? Okay, she's riding high. She's doing so well. The view has been, I know, that she's just going to take it too far, and then everyone's going to think that's been parking with them. Actually, these guys are just too much. Is that the moment?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I thought the moment was when she wore the burqa into the Senate.
No.
You know, because they were on this run. They were on this run. They'd got up to about 19% in the polls. And then she did that. And I thought, okay, that's sort of that's unnecessary, because sort of mainstream voters were starting to flirt with One Nation to come across. Mm-hmm. You know, people were, you know, it's no longer sort of taboo to tell a pollster you would vote for One Nation if election was held now. Yeah, that becomes sort of acceptable. And when she did that, I thought, oh, that'll drive away the fence sitters or the waverers, because that was such a sort of silly, unprovoked thing to do. But then, you know, their vote's gone up 10% since, and she's sort of supremely confident. So I don't know. I think the sort of bigger problem that these comments she made this week may cause is that Barnaby was pretty quick out of the gate to disavow them. You know, I think when you talk about the moment, I think we're all looking for the moment, if one comes, that when Barnaby and Pauline have a falling out. A la Latham and Pauline have a serious falling out.
Barnaby's answer was interesting though, PK, wasn't it? I mean, he said, why are you asking me? He wasn't comfortable with the burqa.
Well, he said it in Four Corners to me. Like, he said, yeah, exactly. I'm not going to run it like that. And then he said this line, which I just think not enough has been made of, because it blew my brain when he said it to me, Phil, which was, I've got to get people to vote for me in Western Sydney. Whoa.
Well, there's certain things that work for Pauline that don't work for me, and I'll give you a classic one, the burqa, right? That is not something that works for me. It works for Pauline, but it does not work for me. You know, I'm standing for the Senate in New South Wales, not in Queensland, and I understand, because I've been a senator in Queensland, these are two different states, and I have to be relevant in Sydney, especially in the western suburbs of Sydney.
What was he saying, though? Like, decode exactly. That. He's like, I've got to get Muslims to vote for me.
Yeah, Barnaby's not a racist.
He's not.
No, he's not.
Look, he's not.
Yet, he's joined a race party.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, One Nation is at this sort of point at the moment where it is now, you know, one in four people are backing it in the polls. And yes, a lot of that is still grievance. And both Hanson and Joyce will tell you that vote is anything but consolidated. It's a protest, but it needs to be consolidated. And so they're at this point where they got to be better than that. You know, they've actually got to sort of broadly more reflect the mainstream, and that includes immigrant voters and stuff as well. And this is, I don't think the point has been reached, Patricia, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I don't think it has
either. We'll see what the polls say. But, yeah, all the grievance that's driving their vote is still very much out there. And I think it'd take a lot more than this to sort of burst the bubble at the moment. You know, housing, you know, the cost of everything, the congestion, you know, the loss of amenity, these sorts of things, you know. It all comes back to immigration.
It does. And I think it's worth pointing out here too, though, that these comments from Pauline Hanson have angered many, but they've angered particularly members of the Muslim community. And they're under pressure already, this community, since Bondi. We know that. There's been a rise in Islamophobia. We've got the story now of Sydney's largest mosque receiving yet another letter. This is the third, I think, they've received since Bondi, threatening to kill all Muslims. You know, this is dangerous stuff from Pauline Hanson. She was asked about, you know, good Muslims, no good Muslims. And as she was allegedly trying to backtrack on that, she then talked about not feeling safe in Lakemba. And, you know, this is Ramadan is about to start. Lakemba hosts the Ramadan night markets, which so many Australians go to and love. And Pauline Hanson is out there saying Lakemba is not a safe place for basically Anglo non-Muslim Australians. And, you know, if Barnaby Joyce was worried before, I think he'd be very worried now, because, as he said, he's got to win votes in Western Sydney. But it goes to that bigger question of social cohesion. Political leaders, you know, have such a key role in trying to rebuild men's social cohesion at the moment, particularly in the wake of Bondi. And these comments from Pauline Hanson have just gone completely the other way. And, yeah, she didn't dial it down when she was asked to walk it back. She dialed it up.
Yeah, that's a shtick though, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, social cohesion, it really just is a term nowadays, isn't it?
It's a problem.
It's a big problem, but it's a problem at every level.
I want to just get you on that before we go to this reshuffle, Phil, like a problem at every level.
Oh, I mean, like most people, you know, I spend a lot of time just, you know, staring at Facebook and stuff like that at night. But I just sort of noticed people are at war with each other over virtually everything. You know, you can go online and, you know, electric vehicle drivers are at war with petrol car drivers. You know, in society is just breaking down into these micro battles about everything. You know, people imposing their choices on others and others hitting back. And, you know, I think social cohesion is sort of down the S bend at the moment. It's not just sort of this religious political, you know, headline stuff with its anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. But it just at every level, people are just angry and yelling at each other over everything.
Phil, the other thing that happened this week, and it's played out very much into this whole debate around immigration and national security, is Angus Taylor's reshuffle of his front bench. It wasn't just a tweak, was it? It was a complete overhaul.
This is a team that blends proven experience with the next generation of coalition talent.
What was the message, you think, writ large in this reshuffle?
It was just to put a conservative edge on everything that had already been saying, Fran. I mean, everything Angus Taylor has come out with since he took the leadership, the key themes they were going to punch on, the economy, you know, back to responsible budget management, you know, living within your means, hard line on immigration. Susan Lee was saying all those things.
Totally.
It was no different. But sometimes all you need to do is change the messenger. One of the advantages of when you do change leader is you do get a window where people are listening to you. You know, you have the microphone at least for a week, maybe a couple of weeks. I still have this weird memory of being in David Jones buying a toaster back in late 2000. And,
yes.
late 2006. And I'd just written this column for the Sydney Morning Herald how this new Labor leader called Kevin Rudd, who had just lit up the place since, you know, rolling Kim Beazley a month before, had actually announced nothing new. Everything Rudd had come out with, Beazley had announced, you know, carbon prices and education revolutions, and that's just no one had noticed. And I remember buying the toaster and the phone rang and it was Kim, and he goes, "Thanks for noticing, mate. No one else has." and it's a bit like that. Lee was going hardcore on immigration, as we saw from that thing that got leaked earlier in the week. That was clearly, you know, her office was putting that out on behalf of her office, just so Taylor couldn't steal her thunder and announce this sort of measure as his own. She gave a very good speech to the Centre of Independent Studies last year, followed up by Ted O'Brien about spending restraint, budget discipline, a return to that sort of, you know, old school way of managing economies, so we could actually pay for things rather than just keep borrowing stuff. But Taylor's just basically got the same messages. I mean, I think he's got, especially in Treasury, he's got a, you know, Ted I thought was pretty good, but Wilson, you know, Tim Wilson, he's just a force of nature, you know. And just get more sort of stronger messengers delivering the same message. Immigration, well, he's kept Jonathan Dunham in the Home Affairs portfolio, which is the senior portfolio, but he's wrapped that junior immigration portfolio, which was held by Paul Scar, who was a moderate, who was sort of pushing back at some of these more extreme ideas, and that's just been given to Dunham as well. So, but more generally, I mean, I can't remember a time ever where a reshuffle mid-term, they've replaced both the shadow the treasurer and the finance minister, either as shadows or ministers. It was interesting, you know, I thought James Paterson was a good finance spokesman. He wanted to go to defence. But Claire Chandler, you know, we don't know much about her. She's pretty hard line from Tassie, but she's only 35.
Wait, explain what you mean by hard line, because this is interesting.
Well, the first, most I know about Claire Chandler, she's a sort of member of the conservative right who sort of came into parliament, you know, talking about transgender issues and stuff like that. I never really associated her with economic
policy. She has
policy.
Spent a lot of time talking about basically the gender ideology that she, like, yeah, that's what.
Yeah, that's what, yeah. Women in sport and those sorts of things, you know, the Catherine Deves type thing, but that's sort of how she's sort of build a name for herself around in the Liberal Party. But look, she does have an economic pedigree. She has worked as an economic consultant, so I'm very curious about her. But the fact she's only 35 and Wilson's only 45 speaks to sort of generational change in terms of economic thinking. So even though the old principles of, you know, sound economic management have to apply, you're going to have to think of different ways to do it because the economy has changed so dramatically in the last 20 or 30 years. So I thought it was a clever reshuffle. I mean, it's the usual stuff. You've got to, Ron Reagan said, you've got to dance with the one that brung you. So, you know, all the supporters, some who are completely talentless, had to get promoted.
Which one? Would you care to name those?
Oh, no. To replace some equally talentless people. But I thought it was a clever reshuffle in a way. I mean, the one thing Angus Taylor is good at is the economy. He wasn't a very good shadow treasurer and he struggled to articulate, but I've been watching him speaking since. He's comfortable
talking
about it. I
think he's improved. Has he been practicing quietly?
Yeah, yeah. He must have been. But, yeah, he believes it and he's comfortable in talking about it, and that makes a big difference. He's what's happening to the economy at the moment with, you know, interest rates, inflation back out of control, another rate rise. We've seen the Prime Minister and the Treasurer clash this week with the former Governor of the Reserve Bank. Politics being the binary business it is, you know, if people start to look at the other side and go, oh, actually, you know, they seem to know what they're talking about. It just may be a way back in for the Liberal Party, and I think it's a proper strategy to go back to what used to work for you, rather than you know, culture wars and all that sort of malarkey.
Yeah. So, well, but he's going to have to manage because he's also brought back Jacinta Nambujipa Price, who has offended the Indian community, and now she's in this small business world. Guess who owns a lot of small businesses?
I mean, I'm really curious, Patricia. You know, ditto Andrew Hastie, who he's sort of cornered into this industry portfolio.
Again, with very, which is what I was trying to say in Four Corners through these all these people we spoke to, very different economically on these issues. So that's interesting too, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think he'll be imposing tariffs anytime soon. I think Hastie's the guy who's been now charged to sort of run down net zero. You know, I think he's been told, mate, you can't talk about protectionism and industry assistance and all those sorts of things. That, you know, no more posing by 1969 Ford Falcons, you know, hankering for us to start building V8s again. But Hastie will start making this case. You know, he'll be the chief net zero challenger. It was interesting that Dan Tehan was left in energy. I mean, the Liberal Party virtually has no energy policy now.
Yeah.
You know, they followed the Nats last year in jettisoning net zero, but the Nats actually have more of an energy policy than the Liberals. They at least have paying lip service to cutting emissions. The Liberals do nothing.
It was interesting both Angus Taylor and Jane Hume brought up nukes, though, straight away.
Oh, yeah, but again, that's old is new again. I mean, Susan Lee said that from the get-go.
Yeah.
We'll lift the moratorium. We'll never get the private sector to build it again like we promised before the last election.
They've taken away the idea of subsidising, though, to be clear.
Again, it's a new people saying an old thing and it's being noticed.
Yeah, but it's also new people saying old things clearer. I mean, PK, you're right. These are a handful, these sorts of front benches. Senator Nambujimba Price, Andrew Hastie, you know, they've got strong views. They are very strong communicators. They cut through, as is the new Shadow Treasurer, Tim Wilson. And, you know, already we've seen the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, come out on the front foot with some, you know, I'm sure they think they're really great zingers, you know, labelling Tim Wilson the most extreme Treasury spokesperson yet.
Ever.
More of the same. He's just out. He's just another Liberal who doesn't support Medicare, penalty rates, superannuation, work from home. You know, he had a barrage of insults for him to try and, which indicates he's worried about him, I thought. But, you know, I thought you had the best zinger, actually, Phil, when you said Wilson is harder to get rid of than a blackberry bush.
Yeah.
Ah, that's so good.
I actually used to use that line originally about Christopher Pine. You know, bushfire goes through a gully and the first thing that grows back is the blackberries. You know, Wilson reminds me a lot of Pine. He's sort of fearless, shameless. The more you abuse him, the stronger he becomes. He's utterly convinced in what he's doing and thinking and saying. I mean, he is tough, Tim. We all saw what he did to Labor as a backbencher in 2019 when he took charge of the franking credit campaign. And he has a track record. He's the sort of person you want in opposition. You sort of turn the key in his back and point him at the other side and say, go for it.
he's got a million of them, Phil.
He's economically literate. He's got ideas. He's not shy. And, you know, as Jim Chalmers will find out, sort of personal slurs or whatever are just not going to work against him. You can't cow him with intimidation.
He doesn't care. He just keeps bulldozing his way through, doesn't he?
Yeah. And don't forget, this guy, you know, clawed back against all the odds, including none of his colleagues thought he could do it, win back a seat from Attil.
Yep.
He's the only Liberal who sort of went back into the trough after the rest of them all disappeared when they lost their seats.
Literally.
Yeah, but Tim said, no, from a spectator point of view, it's going to be a fascinating duel between him and Chalmers. But, you know, my favourite thing about Wilson is every day since he's been back in Parliament, he wears these ocean blue socks. And he's bought, like, all these pairs of these ocean blue socks, and he only wears them in Parliament. They're the Liberal blue. And his motto is, never again will Till be shown in the seat of them. Yeah, seat of Goldstein.
Blue, not teal.
Yeah, and it's the liberal ocean blue.
Yeah.
he can be completely outrageous, but he actually is, you know, he thinks about policy a lot. He's not
He does.
Unlike Christopher, who wasn't a great policy brain. And it's gonna be a formidable challenge for the Treasurer, I think.
Mm. I agree. And can I just a little plug? We did an interview series over summer and I interviewed Tim Wilson, and you kind of get a sense of his character in the interview. It's in Politics Now feed. You know, just like the backstory of Tim and, you know, the way homophobia shaped him, the way why he's such a fighter and an outsider. I think it's sort of, there's a lot of psychology there, like there is with all of us, right? And I find him an interesting figure in that sense too. I think that's why you could say anything about him and he just keeps going.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be popular. He wants to be respected, I think, is the he's a very polarising character. I mean, a lot of people just can't stand him, including some on his own side. But, you know, he's a crash-through guy. It's sort of, you see people like that in politics every now and then, and you just think, if everyone worked as hard as that person.
That's right.
You know, on sort of, you know, policy and getting back into government, the whole show would be in better shape.
He's got to where he wants to get now. I mean, he's got further he wants to get, I'm sure of that.
Well, this is the other thing I find fascinating, because we all sort of talk about, look, if Angus Taylor doesn't work out, you know, they decide to bump him off at Christmas next year, for example, you know, 6 months from the next election, and the assumption has been, oh, that it'll be Andrew Hastie's turn. I wouldn't rule out Timmy time either. I don't think Wilson would stand by and let Hastie sort of walk into the
leadership. No, I agree, but that's where the deeper divides are actually the story. And Raph and I were saying yesterday this in Politics Now, right? It's not just characters, it's the deeper politics. And Tim Wilson does not want to champion some of the really hard rhetoric, for instance, on immigration at the moment. Mm. You'll notice he's not doing that.
Hey, very Phil, careful. Let's go from Timmy time to Jimmy time again, yes. I mentioned that Jim Chalmers came out of the blocks early against Tim Wilson, but Jim Chalmers had a few problems of his own, because he copped a spray from the former Reserve Bank Governor Phil Lowe. I think this was in your newspaper, the Financial Review. He said the government's fiscal management had led to inflation and low productivity. Jim Chalmers wasn't having it at all, Phil.
Obviously, I think it's a matter of public record. Phil Lowe would have liked to have been reappointed by the government. After he wasn't reappointed by the government, he's become a fairly persistent critic of the Labor government in the pages of the Financial Review and elsewhere. I think to some extent that's just human nature. I understand that. But I have a very respectful view of Phil Lowe. Now, when it comes to...
No, neither was the Prime Minister. I mean, they both stuck it to Lowe. I mean, the PM, I thought, was... even a little more unedifying. He sort of said, which Phil Lowe are we talking about, the former governor or the former rugby union player, league player? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Who apparently is no longer with us. So Albanese completely belittled him. And then Chalmers basically said, we sacked him.
He wanted to keep his job and he didn't.
What does that tell you? So they just both went straight for the man.
Yeah, suggesting basically he's just bitter, right? Like that's the thing.
Yeah, rather than the substance.
And doesn't know anything.
Yeah, it was pretty out there, I thought. I mean, Lowe had been saying that. I remember as governor he was saying that. He was making these sorts of warnings about needing to get productivity up. In fact, I remember, a story I wrote right at the start of this, when the government came in, where Lowe addressed the House Economics Committee. Told them, and it leaked out, that I think if you this is when we're talking about these sort of massive pay rises, if wage rises get ahead of productivity increases and stuff like that, you're going to have a big problem with inflation.
Yeah, but you know what he'd also said before that, sort of contrary to that, I thought at the time, during the Morrison years where wages were just stalled, right, or going backwards, there'd been very little wage growth for a long time under that government, and Phil Lowe said that's not acceptable, you've got to do something to get wages up.
Yes.
Now, he was talking linked to productivity, but, you know, he was definitely spruiking for higher wages that
put pressure
on the Morrison government.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we've seen this week that real wages are dropping again after Labor had made some inroads into that.
Yeah, the trouble is it's not so much wage growth, it's inflation, Fran. You know,
yeah, it's real wage growth.
Yeah, wage growth is defined by wage growth.
It's how people feel.
Inflation. But if inflation is staying stubbornly high, you get stuck in this
perilous
cycle where you're trying to chase inflation with wages. And that's for one of the reasons why we are where we are now, rather than trying to get inflation down. That's the more sort of durable and sensible way to get about it. But look, either way, I mean, he had his problems with the Morrison government too, as I imagine. Morrison was had a few sort of disagreements with Lowe. And then, of course, you know, Lowe made that huge mistake during COVID where he said interest rates would stay at record lows till 2024, remember? Yep. And then clearly that, you know, the Reserve Bank, like everyone, didn't quite get COVID right. They cut rates too hard and too low. And one of the reasons we sort of inherited that massive inflation spike wasn't just because of all the money the government spent on JobKeeper and everything. It was because interest rates were so low. And that, in turn, you know, it contributed to the blow-up in house prices. So, you know, they've all made mistakes, but I think what Philip Lowe was saying the other day to my colleague Patrick Durkin was sort of fairly just basic stuff. You know, productivity is stalled. There's too much spending in the non-productive sector. He's not the only one to make these observations. It's sort of fairly uncontestable what he said in terms of what's contributed to the current economic circumstances. What stood out to me was the sort of vehemence of the government's reaction.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's exactly right. It goes to the sensitivity they have over the economy, because while they're enjoying the sideshow bob of the coalition that's trying to get their stuff together now, but really, let's be honest, they've been an absolute clown show for the last month.
Clown show?
They have. Am I wrong?
Love it. I love it.
I was sitting on Wednesday. It was a month on Wednesday since we had a rush back from holidays
exactly.
early.
Right.
But it's through the system now. This is the thing. I mean, these things do happen. But
exactly. And this is where I'm going to, actually, which is now it will turn and the pressure will be on the government, and they've got the budget, and that ain't going to be pretty, is it, Phil?
That's right. So it's sort of, you know, we're back to where we are, and the opposition, you know, for all its clownery, is looking a lot more settled and sort of solid now than it was, you know, a few weeks ago, regardless of whether it's right or wrong to do what they did. They just always seem that, look, the coalition always seems more comfortable in its own skin when it has a conservative leader. That's just a fact. You know, it's always wrestled with itself when, you know, whether it was Malcolm Turnbull or John Hewson.
It's very true.
They just sit more comfortably with a conservative leader. That's their happy place. And you can sort of feel, you know, everyone sort of feels things are a bit more normal.
Breathing out a bit, yeah.
I thought the smartest line was the day of the coup, when Jane Hume was asked about, you know, do you need to go back to the centre? And she said, plan is to take the Liberal Party forward, not to the left or right.
Sure. Mark, we're going to take the Liberal Party forward, not left, not right. We're not moving towards any one party. We're taking our party and the people that we want to represent forward.
I thought Susan Lee made perfect sense when she said we need to get back to the centre, because that's where all the seats we used to have are. But when you do that, you know, the sky after dark crowd and everything just came after them and destabilised them. So if you just what Hume said gave them is a degree of flexibility. So they'll flick left if it helps them, and they'll flick right if it helps them. I thought that was the most important statement made that day.
I think that was a really powerful point. I'm not convinced though that everyone agrees with her. And that's
No. And back to what we were saying about Jacinda Price and Andrew Hastie. I mean, how long are they going to stay in their lane, given these enormous echo chambers in which they exist in their social media world, before they start weighing into immigration again and stuff like that? This is going to be a test for Taylor. It was a smart idea to give them jobs.
Yeah. Keep them busy.
Real jobs. And look, they got to perform. I mean, yeah, Paul Kelly wrote the other day, now's the time to show us how good you are if you are, in fact, good. You know.
Now's the time, and when they do, Phil, we'll get you back on and get your assessment of it. Phil, thank you so much as always. Fabulous.
No problem, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
That's it for the Party Room this week, but keep sending your questions in. We're going to do a special episode, actually, with all of your questions. We like the voice notes. Email them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And remember to follow Politics Now on the ABC Listen app. That's the feed where you find this podcast so you never miss an episode. And we'll also put in the show notes this week a link to PK's Four Corners, because if you haven't seen it, you really should. And also, I want to hear that podcast series with Tim Wilson that you put out over summer, PK. I was too busy relaxing.
Having a nice life. Yeah, fair
having
enough.
Having a nice life.
It's all there. It's in the show notes. And Tim Wilson, it was a really interesting interview. You sort of understand the psychology of him and also other people who we spoke to as well. David Spears will be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday. And then, of course, our regular episode of Politics Now on Monday.
Plenty going on. See you, PK.
See you, Fran.